This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Ling Ma is a writer hailing from Fujian, Utah, and Kansas. She is the author of the novel Severance, which received the 2018 Kirkus Prize, the Whiting Award, and the NYPL Young Lions Fiction Award, and the 2022 short story collection Bliss Montage, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction and the Story Prize. Ma's stories and excerpts have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Granta, Virginia Quarterly Review, Vice, and more. She has been, until recently, as we discuss in this interview, an assistant professor of practice in the arts at the University of Chicago. Ling Ma was awarded a 2023 Wyndham Campbell Prize for Literature in the fiction category. She spoke to me from her home in Chicago, where she lives with her family. Ling Ma, I am so thrilled to be speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining me on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you for asking me to interview.
So Ling, we're going to go on to talk about your novel Severance and your collection Bliss Montage. But first, I want to go back to the beginning and I want to ask, when did you first know that you were a storyteller?
Well, specifically, it took me a long time. I guess I think more in terms of like as a writer rather than a storyteller, because I think storytelling can take many forms. I know a lot of people who are storytellers who are, you know, not writers necessarily. I think when I was in high school, I studied journalism. I did the school newspaper, and I always thought, well, I'll probably, you know, get into journalism. That sounded like an exciting life for me. I always thought I would write fiction, but I figured I'd wait until, you know, when I had amassed a wealth of experience or something and, you know, put out a novel when I was 50 or later in life. But I think after the 2008 crash, you know, I had done a journalism fellowship. I had just completed a journalism fellowship, and the prospects of really doing anything in that field, you know, serious work seemed dire, or the opportunities seemed slim. Another way of looking at it is that I was also just not great at being a journalist. I didn't really have that, you know, killer instinct or that sense of urgency that I think you should have as a journalist. And so I think, based on the circumstances at the time, I just, you know, I was being laid off from a job. And so I just decided to go back to grad school and do an MFA, which is an advanced degree in creative writing at the time. I don't think having an advanced degree made me a writer. I think at the time I felt that I had a lot of things to say, even though I wasn't sure what they were, but it felt like it was going to burst out of me. And so I thought maybe the best way to spend the next few years would be to, you know, pursue a graduate degree in creative writing. Not so much for the degree, because I don't even know at this point whether I'm still not convinced entirely that it can totally be taught. I think craft of writing, craft of fiction can be taught, but I think really what you need is time and money. and that's what grad school provided.
That's great. And I want to talk a little bit later too about how you approach teaching writing as well. But in those years with the MFA-ling, can you remember the first piece of fiction that you had published?
I had published fiction prior to the MFA program. I forget. I think I had published one piece I remember publishing was about a girl, a college age girl whose parents were in town, and she goes to the hotel to meet them. And they invite her to stay in their hotel room, you know, to catch up. And long after her parents are asleep, she sneaks down to the bar downstairs and starts talking to this much older man. And it all takes place in this hotel in Chicago, the Palmer House, that for some reason, when I first went inside, I was so inspired by that I decided wrote this story around it. But that was probably one of the first pieces that I published. Yeah.
Did you feel validated as a writer by that first publication experience?
It was a story I wrote in college. I felt validated by the experience of writing it rather than the experience of publishing it. I wrote the first draft in college, but I didn't publish it until I was maybe 27 or so. And I kept perfecting it, trying to get it to a place where I thought made sense for the story. But that's also, you know, the downside of that is you can be caught in this perfection sort of loop and you can overcorrect too much. And I think it was a bit of that as well. But when you're first starting out and you have no idea, you know, what you're doing, sometimes you tend to overcorrect a little bit. So there was a big delay between, I guess, writing the first draft and then publishing it. And it really didn't change a ton from the first draft. A few things changed. And to be honest, I think I made it, the published version, I think I made it worse than it was. you never, you know, you have to make those mistakes, I think. But I do remember that when I was writing it, I could tell it was, there was something very gratifying about the experience. And I think what made it gratifying is I didn't think, it didn't seem to come from me. It seemed like it was, the story was sort of making moves of its own accord. And it was not something I could have predicted that I would have written. And I think that's maybe the most exciting part of writing, of writing fiction, escaping yourself in a way, even while you're drawing on your own sensibilities.
Is that feeling of it coming from somewhere outside yourself, do you recognize that in the writing process as knowing that you're onto something? Does that have to occur to you for a fiction piece to be good?
I think it's a very good sign. Often I don't really know when I begin a story or a novel, I may have an idea of what's going to happen or some themes I might try to explore, but I usually don't know entirely what's going to happen. And if I already know well in advance what's going to happen, then there's no point. I don't feel excited to write it because I don't know, then it's like writing an essay or something. I think there's something about the creative process that's much more exploratory. You know, you could take a first draft and then do 20 more drafts upon it and find something new. What is the story trying to tell you? And I think that's always a good sign when it's when the story is doing something different than what you would have expected or surprising you in some way. I feel like I'm doing it right when that happens.
Let's talk about the genesis for your award-winning novel, Severance. I read it first when it was released in 2018 and I've reread it in preparation for this interview. And it's obviously taken on some very new layers since you wrote it. Severance is the story of Candace Chen, who's an office worker. She is one of the sole survivors of a deadly fever that has killed most of the US population. Can you tell us about the genesis of Severance, of writing this novel?
Well, I started it thinking that it would be a apocalyptic zombie, maybe short story. I'd been watching a bunch of The Walking Dead, And I think I was a little bit maybe frustrated by the second season and thought, oh, I can inhabit this type of world and maybe I can improve upon it or make it different, make my own spin on it. There wasn't real urgency to the beginning. And I realized that much of the piece where it was most exciting, where the urgency was coming from, was this sort of anger. And a lot of the anger had to do with work. And at the time when I started what became Severance, I was in the last few weeks or maybe the last few months of working at a job, and I knew I was getting laid off, that I knew I would be laid off from in due time. And in fact, I had been asked, they were consolidating offices, closing down the office I was working at, and moving some employees to a pre-existing office on the West Coast. And I was asked to stay behind at the office that was being closed. And in fact, I was one of the last few workers just working in an empty.
Oh, wow.
An empty floor. You know, the lights were darkened. Certain departments were still there, but there were whole departments that were completely dark and empty. And honestly, the work was kind of coming. There wasn't that much work for me to do in those last few weeks. So I just started writing that piece of fiction. So of course I was thinking at the time a lot. I think it was probably my third office job perhaps at that point. And I really didn't want to work in another type of job, similar type of job that I probably could have applied for. And so I think I realized that, you know, it's a rumination. Whatever this story is, it's some sort of rumination on work of some kind.
Yeah.
And I think part of the fantasy, I think, of apocalyptic narratives is that you can kind of shut down things down. And I mean, my desire at the time, my fantasy at the time was never to work again. And the idea was, well, what needs to happen for you not to work again? And it's like, oh, you have to shut down the city. You have to shut down capitalism and have to do all of this. So, and that would fulfill your fantasy of never having to work again. But of course, you know, when you inhabit a fantasy, it becomes something different.
That's so interesting. I've got so many questions there, Ling. What I know that at some stage you were around this time, you were working in the Playboy office. Is this the office that was being closed down?
Yes, this was the Playboy office in Chicago, Playboy magazine. Well, the whole, it was the top, it was two floors of an office building that overlooked Lake Michigan. Very nice. So,
and you were a fact checker.
I was a fact among checker other things. At Playboy magazine. That's right. And I, and it was actually a fun, kind of a fun job sometimes. Just that you would maybe do a lot of fact checking on extensive, you know, investigative pieces, and then sometimes a few like fashion editorials, things like that. And so you kind of would accumulate sort of random bits of knowledge. And actually, as a writer, that was very useful to accrue like random detailed knowledge to, I mean, certain things I've forgotten. I totally forgot like what the difference between a V6 and a V8 engine is, because I did a lot of car research and that has all gone out the window. But other things like how they caught like the FBI sting on John Gotti,
right.
The mobster, like for some reason I've got that whole narrative in my head. Yeah.
It feels like it when I'm thinking about Severance, I'm like, well, that could have been the perfect job for Candace Chen to be working in. Of course, she's not in that. She is in charge, among other things, of the kind of logistics and supply chain of having Bibles printed. Why did you choose Bibles? I mean, it's perfect, but I just want to go into the background of why.
I chose Bibles specifically because it was perfect and because And because I had had some experience that came from another job that I had worked at previously, which although I didn't totally specialize in Bibles, but it was coordinating manufacture of more fancier book projects. And they were all being made in Asia, in various suppliers in Asia. So when you think about the Bible and you think about, you know, what it preaches, and you think about the complete inequity of like labor within the global supply chain, I just thought this is just, you know, waiting to be written. And I think a part of this, you know, understanding that there was a story, I think that came from my journalism sort of instincts. Like I knew, of course, this is absolutely a story, but for some reason, it's just not the story that I could do in like a nonfiction form. I had to expand upon it within the fiction, you know, world by mixing genres. And it seemed like everything fell into place once I kind of figured out where she was working, that it was a novel about work. And once I figured out where the main character is working at, what is the work she's producing, like, of course, this all fits into the apocalyptic narrative in a different way.
Mm. Candace, you know, one of the extraordinary things about her is this diligent return to her job each day as New York kind of grinds to a halt around her. And her, you know, on again, off again, boyfriend Jonathan, on the other hand, has already opted out pre-Shen Fever. He's turning his back on the system and working for the man to pursue his art. They're kind of two sides of the coin. And readers, I imagine, and certainly myself, have sympathy for both approaches to work and to art. Where do you fit on the coin of Candace and Jonathan?
Well, it's, I think, all good stories in some way, it's kind of an argument I have with myself. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely see Jonathan's side. I can definitely see Candace's side. However, Jonathan's side, I guess his perspective about and his sort of fixation on not selling out, quote unquote, mm-hmm. it seems to me more of an outdated fixation mm-hmm. in some way. I really base this off of Generation X and their fixation on not selling out, you know, back in like the 90s, when you read like a magazine profile on some band, the narrative was always like, oh, how do you guys feel now that you move from like an independent label to a larger label? Are you guys going to sell out? Literally, that was like the story of every single magazine profile on a band in like 90s music journalism. And I think Candace lives in a world where I think because she sees the supply chain, because she sees how things are so interconnected, if you live in the world, you are already participating in these like broken systems and unsustainable systems that exploit others. She understands just by living in this capitalist society, you are selling out. So it's not even a question of like resistance. It's not even an option. And so I think her perspective is perhaps more updated. Although I definitely respect Jonathan's perspective, perhaps it also seems a little bit naive these days. Mm.
Can you just describe for our listeners what happens to people in your novel when they contract Shen Fever?
So Shen Fever, I actually based off of something called Valley Fever, which can occur in like the drier desert regions of the US. And the symptoms are very much almost like having a cold or something. It's a fungal illness. It's when you breathe in certain, fungal pores. And the symptoms initially seem like the common cold or something. In the novel, so it's based off of Valley Fever, but in the novel, what happens is that as the condition worsens, the patient then starts repeating like a routine just compulsively from their life. It might be just washing the dishes, or it might be, you know, operating a computer mouse or something, or like flipping the pages of like a book, or putting a dress on over and over. But there's some kind of action that they do often in their lives that they just tend keep repeating compulsively, and until they, I guess, until their condition continues to deteriorate and they I guess expire.
You take the reader from this moment of kind of what feels like realism into horror in some of these sequences, and even just thinking about it, I can feel the stress in my chest, because they're extraordinary scenes. There's also this idea that you explore that potentially there's a link to kind of nostalgia and home that worsens the impact or that brings it on. What did you want to explore in that connection to home and nostalgia?
Well, I thought about sort of the comfort of certain routines. At that point, I think I've been working very similar types of jobs for a while, and it just felt like I felt I was trapped in a loop that I couldn't get out of. And I suppose I also wanted to recreate that aspect somehow in the book. But I also felt maybe part of the reasons that I was trapped in that loop had to be were rooted in maybe some of the familial values that I grew up with. Why did I feel compelled to work in this certain way and pursue certain things? And I think also routine is very comforting. Mm. And at the same time, even when it feels like a trap, it also feels very comforting. So I just wanted to explore both of those, like these patterns that we can't get ourselves out of, and those patterns create this larger system that we cannot seem to get ourselves out of. I don't know if I have a definitive, key to unlocking it, but I was thinking along those lines and try to unpack some thoughts around those lines.
Both in Severance and also in Bliss Montage, your short story collection, you combine realism, speculative fiction, horror, the surreal, the absurd. You've said in an interview that however outlandish the premise, you want your readers to feel emotionally anchored. And I'm really interested as another writer in how you work in between those spaces during the writing process, and whether you have some kind of meter that says, okay, wow, I've pushed it too far, I need to bring it back to, the emotional truth of the character, or is it more kind of instinctive as you go along?
Well, I think sort of juggling between like this sort of hyper realism, like maybe a emotional realism, and then this kind of, and then these outlandish premises. I think a lot for me, what I learned from Severance is that a lot anchors on the voice. So it's written in the first person voice. If the reader finds Candace's voice to be very credible, very believable, maybe almost like their peer, then anything the voice touches as it narrates the story is going to seem much more believable, much closer to reality. And I think I was thinking about zines, reading, I grew up reading personal zines. I was kind of, I guess I was a casual reader of zines in high school and college. And just thinking back to like the kind of voice that you might encounter in a zine, with something with very limited distribution, somebody is just Xeroxing and creating on their, Microsoft Word at home or something. There's something very intimate and a little bit, maybe I would say a little bit more real sounding than I would encounter in literature, in I guess literary fiction. So I try to just think back to zine voice. maybe a little bit diary-like. A lot anchored on the voice. And once I figured out Candace's voice, or once it kind of, came to me, then I felt, this can carry me through the whole novel. I do a lot. I guess I invest a lot in the voice. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I had a question about writing in first person and that inhabiting, I suppose, of other heads and that strong voice. Is that where you start thinking about stories in Bliss Montage as well, with that, with those strong senses of voice for your character?
Yeah, I think a lot. I think for Bliss Montage, many of the stories came to me, the premise came first, and it would often seem like, oh, this is an interesting way to unpack such and such idea. And so I guess for me, I didn't have to worry so much about sustaining, you know, a long form piece. So maybe I worried a little bit less about voice. And I can't say I worried a ton about voice either with Severance. It's the only thing I know is I can tell when the voice is not working. And that's about it. I just try different things out. And I know, you know, in my mind, I can recognize it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And then by the power of deduction, I can kind of come across something that works.
You said of the collection, this is in another interview with NPR, you said that the many of the stories in Bliss Montage started off as sketches that you had for a long time, but that the problem was that they felt very emotional to you. And you said the emotions would kind of volcanically gush forth and then overtake the story, and just scar it completely. I thought that was such a great phrase. How did you move through those scars and kind of smooth them out so that you were happy with that, the resonance in the stories?
Really, it's just time. And some of those sketches that I had, you know, I had them lying around for years. And I might encounter them, you know, a few years later, 2 years later, for instance. And I might recognize something in them that was interesting, but I could also recognize when I was writing it, like, I was too close to the subject matter. Like as a writer, the same as a journalist, it's best to maintain objectivity and it's best to maintain some distance and some detachment. And I think with many of the stories, that could only be achieved with time. Mm-hmm. You know, the same day that I wrote those sketches out, there was no way I would be able to complete that story. But I know there was something about some of those sketches that clearly stayed with me over the years. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at them again, I was able to understand what I was trying to do and do it better because I was a little bit more detached.
They are such a delight to read, these stories. We start off with Los Angeles, in which the protagonist lives in a house in LA with her husband and children and 100 ex-boyfriends. It's the greatest opening to a story. I love it. There is G, where the characters take a drug that renders them invisible. There's sex with a Yeti. There's a door to another world at the back of an office closet. It's such wildly different premises and stories, and yet they all feel very connected. What for you is the through line or the pulse that brings these stories together?
That's a great question. And I'm sure I had some kind of answer to this, like when the book was released, but I'm not sure. To be honest, I'm just not sure. It was published very quickly after it was completed. And I don't think I ever sort of managed to take the step back to really look at them. I think a lot of, you know, the extremes of experience I wanted to convey. And I know there are many themes that continue to come up, such as abuse, trauma, homecomings, returnings to things, immigration, and like bad, you know, shitty romances. All of those are in there. I think, you know, sometimes my goals aren't as lofty as I would just like to convey what a certain thing feels like. And if I can be as accurate and precise in conveying that, then I think that in itself is just a goal, you know, because then another reader could, you know, read it and think, oh, I'm not alone. Or this is, you know, I'm not the only one feeling this way.
In terms of the process of writing them, I really liked a line from an interview where you said that when you'd get stuck on working on one story and you'd pushed it as far as you could get, you'd rotate and you'd move on to another one. And I wanted to ask, what does getting stuck feel like and look like for you? And how do you make that movement between the stories get you cranking again?
It usually means like I think it's usually the plot. I don't know what happens next. I've pushed it as far as I can. I know that the last scene I wrote, the last development in the story is absolutely correct. Like that, I know, but I have no idea what it's setting me up for next. And maybe there isn't something it's setting me up for. I have no idea. So I think usually it's the plot where I am stuck at. And sometimes it's not always clear what the topic is I'm circling around. That becomes increasingly clear the deeper you get into the story. So, you know, even halfway through a first draft, I may still not know what is the topic, is the story circling around, but there's clearly some kind of pull within it. I'm just not sure what it is. Usually those frustrations have to do somehow come out with the plot. Understanding where the story wants to move, how it's supposed to move, understanding its plot is very much linked to understanding what ideas is this story trying to tackle. What are the topics it's trying to think about? I think those plot and, you know, the story's idea is very closely linked.
When you have a story that is stuck and you just cannot make it move, you know, do you just consign it to the bin? Are there stories that you have just said, no, that is a failure and I'm not looking at that again?
Well, for the stories in Bliss, there hasn't been any that I threw away. But I will say, like, in general, like, there are stories where I feel like I've surfaced it entirely. I got the story. I helped the story realize exactly what it wanted to be. And with there are other stories where, you know, I went as far as I could go, and I know the story could be developed a little bit further. And I got most of the way, but I couldn't totally get there for whatever reason. And that's, you know, that's also real too. I'd love to say like I was able to surface each story entirely and fully, but that's not always the case. It's not always the case. I also wanted to be an archaeologist when I was in college. So I think about, you know, you dig in the sand and you put together like some shards that you find to create the vessel, but sometimes you're never going to find all of the shards to put together all of the entire vessel. I do like thinking about stories that way as maybe something that's pre-existing and I'm just putting them back together, because that, you know, relieves the pressure on me of creating something from the ground up. I'm actually just reconstructing something that already existed and there's a way that it's supposed to be. And sometimes I can get it complete, almost identical to what it was before. And sometimes I can get it partly, you know, reconstructed.
That's a beautiful analogy. And it reminds me of, I had the pleasure of speaking to George Saunders for this podcast and his idea about dropping the glass orb. And, you know, when you think about the story and that the job of the writer is to put it back together, which is that phrase of yours, to surface it, is really lovely. You've said in an interview that the best part about starting out as a writer is the freedom to take risks and to make exuberant failures. And I wanted to ask how you guide beginning writers through those failures of craft to get to the other side.
Yeah, well, I think in my experience, particularly with beginning writers, they put a lot of pressure on themselves. So already they're thinking about publication before they know what the story even is, and they want things to be perfect, even though it doesn't really exist, and they also need a lot of assurance that they're not doing it wrong, whatever that means. And I can understand all of that because, you know, I dealt with all of that when I, you know, was just starting out as a writer, and I still probably deal with a lot of that in that form. And so I think in workshops, usually we work with sort of story drafts, partial stories. And so we really talk about where can it go from here and where can it go from here. The plot is also linked to what is this story about. And we actually kind of take turns investigating like different options that, and I think maybe for the writer, just hearing other people brainstorm different options, I think sometimes it kind of shakes them out of this perfectionism sort of like loop, like making like this idea of making teeny tiny baby steps because no step can be wrong. Instead, just thinking we're going to draft a scene and maybe we'll include it into the story, maybe we won't. And I think the other thing about making failures, it's really important, I think, to do a lot of creative exercises in creative writing class, you know, 10-minute exercises that you just dash off and don't think about. You're really trying to get writers to get out of their own way. And I think once you can kind of figure out how to do that regularly, you can get in the business of writing, you know, on a more regular basis, which is really what you need to complete anything. So just doing lots of exercises, trying to showing the writer how to brainstorm different ways and different things to try out. That often, you know, those are, I guess, two methods for beginning writers. Yeah.
Talking about workshopping, because in one of your stories in Bliss Montage, there's some deliciously kind of awkward and poignant workshopping experiences. And I know lots of writers talk about this a lot, and people who teach writing. I know that I came through a writing program, and the workshopping as I was beginning was the key to my getting out of my own way. And yet now, further along the track, I keep my writing, you know, especially my first writing, very close, and I don't really workshop anymore. How do you frame workshopping for your students in the class? What's allowed, what's not allowed, to make that a space that is most useful to everybody?
Yeah, I give them a sheet of guidelines for workshop. And I think one thing that I think we often do in workshop is just present the writer with a problem that the reader has. But we don't go further in saying, let me propose a solution. And something I try to get, because my everyone in workshop to do is when they spot a problem is to also brainstorm a solution to go with it, a solution or an amendment or some alteration to go with that problem. Okay, so if you say, well, I didn't really understand this person's sense of humor, this character's sense of humor. You maybe point to one moment in one scene, in one line, how would you alter that line? Just a small thing. And I think it also gets, you know, I think it gets everyone thinking like a writer.
What's your process of sharing your work? Who do you share your work with, and at what stage?
Well, I share my work with a few readers. Some of them are from actually grad school, and probably like two or three readers. And usually they just tell me what works, what doesn't, and they don't mince words. If I find them that they're being a little bit too nice or generous, I kind of I tend to just focus on people who can just be honest and just, you know, tell me what doesn't work. And sometimes I'll agree, sometimes I'll disagree, but I don't know. If it's a bunch of compliments, I'll know something is wrong.
Moving from that idea of, you know, I suppose the trusted readers who you would share with, to the public facing side of being an author. You said that when Severance was initially published, you kept up with reviews, but it's kind of like staring directly into the sun. And I wanted to ask you what your approach is to the public side of being an author, whether it's events or social media or tours, and whether there's boundaries you put in place before a book comes out, and how these might have changed since the success of Severance.
Yeah, I guess, well, one thing I limit is I don't have any social media as an author. I have like one personal social media account to kind of, you know, just to, I don't know, throw like random basic things up, but it's not as a public facing author. And I think I can do some of the public facing events, but I think with social media, it's something that infiltrates every single day. And so maybe it's easier to think, well, I can maybe prepare a little bit if I have to go and do an event or some kind, or an interview or a recording of some kind, I can at least have a little bit of preparation. I think with social media, it's just so insidious, and it would force me to constantly consider how to appear in the public's eye, that's something I just got rid of, that I just don't do. So yeah.
We often talk on this podcast about what it means to be a good industry citizen, you know, meaning how to support other writers and lift them up and kind of not be a dick. Here in Australia, our lit world is relatively small, obviously, compared to the US context that you're in. What does it mean to be a good industry citizen in the US context of the book world, do you think?
I think it's blurbing other people's books.
Yeah.
I also think, just on a writer-to-writer basis, when you appreciate something, to let them know personally and individually in a way that's not just, I don't know, liking their post or putting comments on their post in some public forum. That, I think, builds, I guess, individual relationships can build that kind of feeling of you're part of a community. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not always the best at all of these things that I've mentioned. I'm mostly kind of a hermit. It helps that I don't live in New York. And that's also been, you know, for the last few years, very much a conscious and intentional choice of not living near the publishing industry. Mm. So actually, I get a lot out of maybe just being a little bit more isolated.
Can you talk at all about what you're working on now? What's coming next for you?
Oh, I think I'm just working on more fiction. It's another book project. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I think what my suspicion of what I'm doing is that, well, a long time ago, before Severance, I had attempted to write this novel, and it didn't really work out. I just didn't really have the skills to really get that project off the ground. And maybe my heart wasn't totally into it as this novel progressed. But I find that with this new project I'm working on, even though the premise is completely different from that novel and the characters are completely different, I think I'm actually tackling the same questions, series of questions. So I just wonder if I'm just like rewriting that novel in some way, which I don't even know if I have a draft of it, but I had a lot of notes and notebooks on it on that previous project. But so I think I might be rewriting something that never made it to publication.
Do you find yourself returning, whether or not it's to an idea like that, or just to those same kinds of themes of immigration, of homecoming, of money, of family? Are they the hot material that you think you'll continue to return to?
I think this one is slightly different, but you're right. I mean, I have like immigration, homecoming, those have all been very prevalent in past work, and maybe those will come up again, but those tend to come up when I'm pursuing what I think is a different question, which with Severance, you know, it was a book about work, and I still see it as a novel about work. But those other themes sort of popped up with that. So I'm not sure. I'll be able to know the deeper that I get into the project.
Ling, you are the recipient of the 2023 Wyndham Campbell Prize for Literature in the Fiction category. Congratulations. This is a prize that writers are nominated for anonymously, so you don't know you're being nominated. That's right. And I think for an Australian, I think this is right, who won it, Helen Garner, the email came into her junk mail and she didn't see it for a long time. It comes with a lucrative prize. What does it mean for you practically to win this prize and for your writing, I suppose?
Well, it's actually made a big difference because without getting too into it, I was in a teaching position that did not have a really workable leave policy. Even I couldn't really manage to get time off, you know, to write. And I was kind of struggling with that. So that fellowship enabled me to resign from my job. So it was quite a big...
Congratulations.
Thank you. So it was quite a big... That made a big difference. I'm actually still trying to figure out, you know, what... This is a recent development. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, fully how to organize my time, but I'll just take a little bit of... some time off just to allow myself to work on some new projects and see where they go. I'll probably go back into teaching later on, but it's given me a few years. So that's a big difference. It's a game changer, really. Yeah.
That's wonderful to hear. Ling, you've already given us such great writing advice in terms of what you share with your students. If there was one thing that you think is most important in terms of sharing with emerging writers and even writers further along in their craft, what's the advice that you give to other writers?
Well, my friend always says to me, and who's a writer herself, always says to me, there are no creative writing emergencies. And I just realized when I'm tearing my hair out over this or that, or I just think it's the end of the world because I cannot figure out what comes next in a story, I just realize there's no emergency here. Like nothing is really, you know, I'm not trying to revive someone from from cardiac arrest. This is just one draft.
That is so good. I'm going to write that up and put it in front of me immediately because it can feel like it's the end of the world. Absolutely. But that is so important.
We all put a lot of pressure on ourselves, so it can sometimes feel a little bit paralyzing. But once you realize that, it's like, oh, okay.
That is so good. Now, Ling, we always finish with the question, and I know that I was going to give you some more time to think about this. Can you recommend for our listeners a debut book, any time or any genre?
Yes, I would recommend actually another collection of short stories. It's called Skinship by Yoon Choi. These are stories about, I guess, immigration, about home, about sort of estranged families and reconciliations. I found them very moving. You know, I remember saying once a long time ago to maybe it was a student or somebody that sometimes when you read a piece of fiction and, you know, the writer saying she walks up a flight of stairs or something, you get the sense that the writer is just making up the flight of stairs, like right in that moment. And okay, we're in a very impromptu way, the world is being made as the story is moving. But I think with certain types of stories, you get the sense that the author has created the entire world, has created all of the characters and relationships and connections, and they've just dropped you into just a little moment of that world and then taken you out again. And so there's something very rich. You're glimpsing something that's been fully fleshed out. and just feels very rich, very full. And that's what I get when I read the stories in Skinship. I should say I was serving as a judge for one of the Penn Awards for story collections. And I found that to be just really one of the most striking collections. And especially the title story, Skinship, is very affecting. But there are many more in there too. So it's a recent release, and I would wholeheartedly recommend that.
Thank you so much, Ling. And thank you for sharing your stories and your insights with us today. Something came up recently on social media, ironically, where someone was asking, you know, who are the authors that you would just read the next thing that they write, regardless of if you know anything about it. And your writing, Ling Ma, certainly stands in that for me. I'm such a fan of both Severance and Bliss Montage, and I'm very excited about whatever you do next. So thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much, Kate.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.